Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Are men getting an unfair deal in today's America? After decades of reshaping ideas about women's roles and their abilities, my guest today would argue feminism has gone too far, not only in deriding men's competence as partners and parents, but asserting that they're not even necessary in many cases. That's a message that Kathleen Parker says hurts not only grown men, but boys, girls, and women as well. Parker is a syndicated columnist and an author. Her new book is called Save the Males: Why Men Matter, Why Women Should Care. Kathleen, welcome to Think.
Thank you very much, Chris. Good to be here.
What tells you that we expect too little of men today?
Well, the culture in general is, over the last 30 years, has become increasingly hostile toward men. And I think part of that hostility is manifested in not only do we not treat men well, but we apparently don't expect them to respond to us meaning women, families, in positive and responsible ways. The book Save the Males is an attempt to shine a light on this whole constellation of dots that if you connect them all, and you see this sort of hostility that manifests in a variety of ways, and then projecting out into the future, you kind of see that men are basically being phased out. So not only do we not seem to think they're essential, but our expectations of men are very low.
Well, you and I are both women, and so when we say our expectations of men are very low, do you mean our expectations as women, or do men expect so little of themselves as well?
Well, I think the culture, you know, not just women individually, but the whole culture embraces this idea that men are pretty worthless. And when you treat men as though, if you treat anyone in advance of their performance, as though they're going to do the worst thing, they're going to be a deadbeat dad, they're going to be violent, irresponsible, or, as we see on television, completely idiotic and incompetent, then at what point do we expect men to say, oh, no, that's not how we are. We're really fantastic. Eventually they retreat into their little caves and say, fine, you know, you got it. You handle it.
And the place where you think this really starts is one of the most influential places in any child's life, which is in the public school system.
Yes. Well, that's one aspect of it, surely. About 1989 or so, we decided that the girls were suffering a self-esteem crisis in this country. And so we decided to revamp education. Sex equity experts became players in this new kind of construct. And we created curriculums that were more conducive to girls' learning, which is great. Nobody wants to withhold applause for the advances girls have made. But at the same time, we tended to pay less attention to boys and their needs and their interests. And I think boy behavior, generally speaking, is not approved and not tolerated as well as girl behavior. I mean, we know how girls are. We are much better at sitting still and paying attention, focusing. As early as kindergarten, teachers report that girls are better focused and they're very good at multitasking. And boys are not. Well, if you're a teacher, if you're an addled, overworked, stressed-out teacher, who are you going to prefer? You're going to prefer the girl behavior. In fact, they have found that multitasking stimulates the pleasure center of the female brain. Somehow we knew that, didn't we?
I don't know that.
Wait,
it's
let me handle this.
But yeah.
Well, but we're good at it. It's a competency that gives us, you know, that gives us daytimers and Blackberries. I mean, I've got mine with me, don't you?
Well, one of the things that you've written about is the housework issue, which is always a big issue every year. And there's a survey all the time that comes out every year or so that talks about men versus women. And you've written about the idea that both sort of do housework, but women are more rewarded by the outcome than men are.
Well, this is these are fighting words, of course.
I was going to say, is that based in science or is this?
Yes, it's based in science. Nobody wants to do housework except for me. I love to sweep. Don't ask me why. I just do. And women get furious. And I am one of you. Believe me, I am one of the girls who comes home from work tired, and I immediately pick up the domestic end of things in a much greater way than my husband does or ever will. I mean, I can put the garbage bag out by the back door, and he can simply walk around it. I can say, you know, those light bulbs are out in the bathroom. He said, yeah, I was just using the other one. It's just a different way. It's a different way of perceiving reality, essentially. Guys just have lower standards, I think, for the most part. I mean, I'm overgeneralizing here, of course. But I think what happens is we get – now you talk about surveys. There are surveys that show women do more of the traditional housework, but those same surveys don't typically take into account the things that men do, particularly with childcare, for example. I mean, women say, I did all the diaper changing, the food preparation, the house cleaning, that sort of thing, which we consider housework. Men might be taking the children out to the backyard to play ball, or they might be coaching a team or doing sort of the more dirty work, the plumbing repairs, whatever. But those things aren't taken into consideration. They are not measured. So it comes out very skewed that women are doing more than men are. They're doing different things. You know, they're doing the finer tasks.
Yeah, that's interesting because the men's stuff gets dropped in the sort of recreation category.
Right. Well, they're having fun.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What tells you, though, that this is not just the dynamics of your marriage as opposed to a statement that you can make generally? Well, when you talked about even the question of you know, your husband walking around the trash bag.
And, yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I've now had two husbands, and it can happen.
But, it's anecdotal, you know. For sure. I've heard from men who say, you know, I've always done more than my wife, so there are exceptions. And by the way, I think my objection to any of this debate about housework is that it creates this unnecessary tension. And this kind of social manifesto that is so I don't see what the point is. I mean, what's an 8,000-word magazine story in the New York Times doing? I mean, about housework, for crying out loud. Work it out. Have a conversation. My husband, I mean, my father raised me. He was a single parent after my mother died. Just to slip back in the anecdotal stuff. And he did all the cooking. He knew how to sew because he took home ec in college. I said, Daddy, why'd you do that? And he said, because that's where the girls were. but he was very good at all those things. It just simply was what you did. You did what was necessary. So I think we create these sort of false tensions within our relationships that probably don't deserve the attention we give it.
Don't you think, though, that the question of the housework manifesto, it comes back to the all politics is local in the absolutely most hyper-local way?
Yeah, but do we really want our home life to be political? You know, it seems like we ought to just sort of hash those things out over the breakfast table and move on to the bigger issues.
Kathleen Parker is my guest. Her new book is called Save the Males, Why Men Matter, Why Women Should Care. One of the things that makes you crazy is the fact that it is socially acceptable in many cases for girls to criticize boys' intelligence. And it's not that you think that boys should be allowed to criticize girls' intelligence, but you're bothered by the double standard.
Heaven forbid you should criticize women's intelligence. We know that we're smarter. We're more competent. We know this because we see it on TV every single day in all the sitcoms. The men are always doofuses. And this sort of, you know, male bashing is a great bonding agent among women. We know this. We know this. We do this. We go to the beach. We bash men. And the sort of trickle-down effect is that the girls are given permission to bash boys, too. I mean, a couple of years ago, we had this great controversy over the T-shirts that came out saying things like, boys are stupid, throw rocks at them, boys are smelly. You can imagine the outrage if we let girls wear wear T-shirts that were equally hostile toward little girls. And as I say in Save the Males, I'm not so concerned whether boys have their feelings hurt, because my guess is they don't care that much. But I do worry about a culture that applauds little girls' hostility toward boys. And where does that lead? You know, at what point do we say enough is enough? And how are we hurting their opportunities to have relationships at some point without that carrying over into the adult sphere, where we continue this idea that men are inferior and not to be respected?
Now, I know that there are people shaking their fists at the radio right now that say men are still running everything in this country. We've yet to have a male president. We're still not going to have one this time. We men are the majority in Congress and in most political positions. How can you argue that men are sort of not getting their fair share?
Well, you're exactly right. I mean, they are on top at the moment, but I'm talking about projecting into the future. If you look at today's trends, you connect all these little dots, sort of see the picture they paint, and you project it forward. If we continue on the current trajectory, then it's not going to be even. It's not, you know, women are doing better. And, you know, it takes time. I mean, these things, we're a couple of generations into this. We will have more women in Congress at some point. We will have a woman president. All those things are going to happen, assuming women want them. You know, not all women really have that kind of ambition, but these things will level out with time. The problem is, just look at the college graduation rates today. In 2005, 133 women graduated to every 100 men. So that's a pretty good gap. And by the end of the decade, it's supposed to be 142 women to 100 men. So the question is, who are our daughters going to marry and, you know, make their mates? I'm not so concerned about the guys in place now. They can handle it, clearly. But where does this lead, and what is it? What does it mean to the family ultimately? Are we going to have more and more women deciding to opt out of marriage and leave fathers out of the equation? And I think, you know, it's already happening in some demographics. You just have so many women who can't find eligible men. So you don't have, you know, you don't have men and women who can combine to form these families that we think are so necessary to our nation's strength.
Let's talk about women in the military. This is something that you think, not in the military, but specifically in combat positions. You don't think they belong there?
Oh, absolutely not. This is a real tough conversation to be having right now because women are at risk in the military. But those who did enlist had every expectation that they would not be in combat because they are forbidden. We have a combat exclusion for women for a very good reason. We've worked very hard for a long time, centuries, you know, to create civilization, and civilization has felt that women didn't need to be fighting mano a mano against men for obvious reasons, I mean, at least reasons that should be obvious. But Iraq and Afghanistan have produced a new situation, that is that the front line is not clear, and women are now in so many positions where they are put right next to combat battalions, which, by the way, they're not supposed to. There's been some rule bending in the Pentagon to make that happen. And consequently, women are being injured and killed at higher rates than ever before. And part of the reason we can have this conversation at all now is because we've never had this many women this close to combat before. Unfortunately, you know, there are certain feminists who very much want to see women in combat because that is the only route to a woman reaching the highest ranks in the military. You have to have led a combat unit. What they're arguing now is that because women are being injured and dying at the same, you know, not at the same rate as men, but at least in greater numbers, the conclusion is, well, they're already in combat. But that's actually not true. And it's real important that Americans understand the definition of combat. It's very specific, and it means to actively and aggressively engage the enemy with the expectation of physical contact. So that's very different than being in the wrong place at the wrong time. And we're yet kind of gradually sort of slipping into the direction of saying women are already in combat, therefore there should be no exclusion. But you have to understand, when there is no exclusion, first of all, combat puts women at a great disadvantage physically, they're not as strong as men. We know that. We certainly know that when we're promulgating rules against domestic violence, right? The women are not as able to fight men on an equal basis. They have half the upper body strength and all that sort of thing.
Well, their arguments, let me interrupt for just a second, about technology, meaning that it's not so much mano a mano as it used
Fallujah.
To be.
It is. It isn't. We're not in a push-button military environment right now. And the idea that we are is a dream. I mean, yeah, someday maybe we'll just push buttons and laser guns and everybody disappears and we're all vaporized and doesn't matter whether you're male or female.
But I'm hoping for that day.
No, but that's not where we are. I mean, we have this sort of Star Wars idea, but that's not the reality. Fallujah was door to door, you know, mano a mano. It was nasty. And we don't want to put women in that position. They don't have an equal opportunity to survive, which is the ultimate feminist argument.
My guest is Kathleen Parker. She's a syndicated columnist, and her new book is called Save the Males, Why Men Matter, Why Women Should Care. Our telephone number, if you'd like to join us, is 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, a way to keep your greatest two tools, imagination and curiosity, sharp.
You
You are listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Kathleen Parker. She's a columnist, and her new book is called Save the Males, Why Men Matter, Why Women Should Care. You can join us by sending email to think at KERA.org, or you can call 1-800-933-5372. I don't want to spend the whole show on this, but I want to get back just to one more point on the question about women in combat.
Uh-huh.
And that is the argument that there are plenty of men who don't belong in combat positions. And why not simply redefine the criteria by which we assess people's suitability for combat with something that doesn't begin and end with gender?
So we only put in big-boned men and women?
I don't know what the criteria would
be. I'll tell you why we don't. Sex. I don't know if you've noticed this, but when men and women get together in confined environments, especially under great stress, they have this odd attraction to each other. And
so you think they're going to be sleeping together in a tank while they're being fired?
I don't think.
It's really?
Not a tank, clearly, but you're not fighting every minute of the day. And, you know, women who've been over there report that it's quite an active environment sexually. And the problem with that is that it disturbs unit cohesion. Because we also know what love produces, these other emotions called jealousy and envy and recriminations. And so you have all these other dynamics entering into an environment that really needs to be focused. So that's really the reason. It does undermine unit cohesion, and there's, you know, it's a fairly big problem. And when people leave the military, they'll talk very honestly about it. But it's kind of a tough subject to bring up when people are involved. And, you know, there's some fairly strong pressure on people to play along with the idea that men and women are equal in all ways. And once they're out and can speak honestly, that's not the story that you hear. So it's creating problems. And then you've got commanding officers who are having to separate basically kids. I mean, we're talking about 18-year-olds, you know. We're not talking about adults who have already raised children and whose libidos are in retreat. These are kids right out of high school who are suddenly thrust into these very intimate situations, and it's a lot to deal with at a time when you don't need those distractions.
Kathleen Parker is my guest. Her new book is called Save the Males. So, setting aside the idea of the military and combat positions completely, does the fact that men and women are inherently different in certain ways play into our ability to live as complete equals? Will we never be completely equal? Are we already completely equal? Can we strive toward equality?
Well, it depends on how you, not to be Clintonian, but it depends on how you define equal. I mean, I personally say equal opportunity, equal under the law, but we are clearly quite different. And we respond to situations differently. We bring different talents and skills and gifts to the table. And I think those are the things that make life interesting and rich, and that we ought to be celebrating rather than always trying to pretend they don't exist. I mean, they clearly do. Let me just, you know, just hormonally, we have so many different things going on. Oxytocin really ought to come with a warning. That's that hormone that surges with women when they have babies and when they cuddle. I make my husband give me a 30-second hug every night, so I get my oxytocin fix. You know, that's the bonding agent. That's the thing that says, I love you, I trust you, I want to be with you. And women get it from a 30-second hug. Men need you know, their microwaves. They need a little bit more of a jolt, and I think you know what I'm talking about. But just that alone suggests that we've got very different mechanics going on.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak to Nancy in Dallas. Hi, Nancy.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I listened to the title of her book, and I certainly do agree that men are very important in especially the lives of a family. But from listening to what she's saying, it seems like she's pushing ERA back into the 50s again. I have three daughters, and I raised them to want to, you know, find a man who honors them and wants to be engaged in having a family and what it means to be part of the family, rather than the father's no nest scenario, where the father does, you know, goes to work, and then when he comes home, the dinner's on the table and the kids are all cleaned, and he just sits down and watches his newspaper or his news. And that still is what our society is the role of the father. Now, some of our counterculture, the fathers are now staying home and the mother's working, and that's very few and far between. So I think from her book coming out at this stage in time, it's too premature, because we are still back in the 50s from most of our culture. There's so much abuse at home because the man does, you know, intimidate the woman. The woman doesn't get as much salary as a man in the same position. And I'm, as far as myself, I would do very well in a combat position because I enjoyed playing soldier with my older brother when I was young, and I can shoot better than he can. And so I'm thinking, you know, I'm not going to have sex, even though I live, you know, I work in a pretty much predominantly male-dominated, I work in a kitchen. And I don't want to have, it's a very stressful situation, and I don't want to have sex with the people I work with.
Nancy,
so I'm taking issue with this.
You brought some great points up, and I want to make sure that Kathleen has an opportunity to respond. So thank you
very
so much for your call.
Thank you.
Well, there's so many things you brought up. I certainly am not trying to push women back into the 50s. You know, I was raised to be a feminist by my single father, and that meant be self-sufficient, independent, and all that sort of thing, and certainly not beholden to a man. My own marriage is very much equal partners, but we, you know, we have different talents and different skills, so we divide them up accordingly. But, you know, it's interesting what first of all, I don't think that most people are still in the 50s. I think this varies a great deal according to demographics. Young people coming along today in their 20s have very different ideas about how parenting and housework and all that things should be divvied up. I mean, they've sort of marinated in this culture longer and have this idea that that men and women are fairly equal in the important ways. But let's just talk about the abuse thing. I mean, there are so many myths out there that are circulating and that are just frankly wrong. As a matter of fact, the studies, the preponderance of research now shows that women instigate violence as often as men do in the home. 25% are initiated by women, 25% of incidents are initiated by men, and 50% are this sort of back and forth dynamic of and it's really a matter of partner violence, family violence. I just finished reading a book by Linda Mills called Violent Partners, and she's a professor at NYU, and she's trying to kind of dissolve some of these myths and talk more openly about how we really deal with family violence. And I don't want to over focus on that particular aspect, but it's just to show you how these things get distorted and how we assume that we know certain things that really turn out not to be true. Now, what is true is that women are hurt more often than men, even though they may instigate the violence. They're hurt more often and they die more often. And the reason is because men are bigger and stronger. And that, yet again, you know, we seem to understand that when it's in the home, but we want to just pretend it doesn't matter when we're talking about combat. By the way, speaking of combat, I don't mean to at all suggest that all women want to have sex with all men in the military, and there are many who are completely safe from these attractions. But and by the way, women do make excellent snipers. This is one of the things they do really, really well. They're great sharpshooters, great marksmen, and that is a different that's a different category than combat. Combat, specifically as defined by our U.S. military, means the potential for mano a mano. So I want to make that clear. And as I have said, there's lots of roles for women to play, very important roles in the military. But I think we want to steer clear of this idea that they belong in combat with men. And here's a couple of other reasons why. Once you get, you know, some people ask, I think Chris said, why not let some women be in combat and others not, according to their wishes? We get very confused when we start talking about our rights in the military. You don't have rights in the military. The military has a very specific purpose, and you're assigned jobs according to what you can contribute to that machinery. But once you allow some women to do it and some women not, then you open up the debate for men to say, well, why can some women do it and I can't? I mean, why do they have choices and we don't? That's discrimination. So then you eliminate, you'd have to eliminate that choice, quote unquote. Then, so once you have men and women in combat, then you no longer have any reason not to also draft women into combat, should a draft ever be put back in place. So I think we really need to ask ourselves if we're quite ready to head down the road toward having our 18-year-old daughters put in combat against enemy men who will do horrible things to them, you know. And it's, you know, we don't have rape camps for men, generally speaking.
I don't know that it would be any easier for most mothers to see an 18-year-old son drafted than a daughter.
It wouldn't be any easier, but at least you know that men are going to be fighting men. When you put women, I mean, women fighting men is not what civilized nations do.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Richard in Dallas. Hi, Richard.
Hi. Kudos to you, Chris, for this program and to the guest also. I just wanted to make a quick comment. I, of course, am a male and I live in Texas. And I just wanted to make a comment saying that I know we really very briefly touched on families here with the last caller in. But basically, I just wanted to say that males in general have somewhat of a disadvantage because they are males in the legal system in Texas when dealing with separated families, because they're automatically seen as the lesser parent. And therefore, they have to do 10 times as much legally to try to get equal rights for their child, just so that they can see the child and so on and so forth. And I'm dealing with that myself, trying to see my daughter as much as possible. It's most people assume that males are like, oh, well, whatever, I'll just see my child whenever. But it's some men are not like that. I love my daughter very much, and I'm having to fight tooth and nail just to see her as much as I can. And I just want to leave my comment. Thank you.
Thanks for your call, Richard. It is something that Kathleen deals with in the book.
Yeah, I deal with that fairly extensively. It's so important that we are honest about the role fathers play in their children's lives and the role that most fathers want to play. We have this cultural idea that men are somehow, as you say, lesser parents and have less interest in being parents. We tend to focus so much on the aberrations, the deadbeat dads, et cetera, that it taints the overall picture, which is something else. In fact, most men, just talking about the deadbeats alone, most fathers, when they are involved in their children's lives, have always paid their child support on time and in full. And most fathers are usually the ones who are made visitors to their children's lives when child custody is arranged. That's such an odd word, I think. In fact, the average number of days that children of divorced parents see their father is 50 days out of the year, which is hardly a parenting relationship. It's more of a visitor relationship. And I think the family, the people who are following these things closely are trying very hard to shift the focus in courts from an assumption of one parent having full custody to at least an ideal of shared parenting. And, you know, that gets all very complicated because no size fits all. And I almost hate to see it become something that the courts handle, because then you're splitting the child in half and, you know, 3 days here, 4 days there. It all becomes confusing. So what I would urge is that anyone considering divorce sit down with their spouse and say, look, we once loved each other and we still love our kids, so let's do the thing that's best for them, rather than going to court, which is necessarily adversarial.
You've also written about sort of this reverence for single motherhood in this country and the damage that you think it's doing to children's lives. Can you talk about that?
Well, yeah, we seem to now sanctify the single mom. And having once been a single mom, I'm perfectly happy to wear my halo because it's hard work, as you and I were talking about earlier. But the idea that should be applauded is a curious development in the culture. And this starts way back with, the Murphy Brown, the People magazine celebrating Jodie Foster, and on and on and on, the celebrity moms.
Although
who,
Jodie Foster had a partner, and it sort of wasn't out there, but she had someone else with her.
Well, to each her own. You know, I'm not saying that Jodie shouldn't have done what she did, or that any mother, whatever decision you make, I'm not passing judgment. What I am talking about is the cultural celebration of single motherhood, as though that's just as good as any other configuration. Sometimes it's forced on us by circumstances, sometimes by necessity, but I think we still need to strive for the ideal of a mother and a father for each child. All the social studies show that children who grow up in an intact family do the best, or they have the highest the likelihood of performing well in school and having successful relationships as adults. Those social pathologies that we now talk about a great deal, truancy, delinquency, drug abuse, pregnancy, all those things that so many teenagers are having problems with, those kids are usually the higher risk for those pathologies are associated with children who come out of fatherless homes. So we know we have lots of social science showing us the importance of fathers, not to mention our own just common sense and experience that the dads are bring something to the family that is of great value in terms of how we build our own identities and how we have our own adult relationships down the road.
So how do we get to a place where we encourage fathers in a new way to take an active part in their children's lives, or encourage mothers to ensure that there are fathers present for their children, without returning to the sort of culture of Diana Ross singing Love Child and the stigmatization of children who have no control whatsoever over what involvement their parents do or do not have in their lives?
Well, I'm with you that we don't want to return to the days of stigmatizing children, clearly. And I know I'm very well aware of the arguments that if we don't give birth to these children that we conceive out of wedlock, the alternative is even more objectionable within those same circles that are so condemnatory. But I think, first of all, we have to wake up to the fact that we're creating this whole a generation of kids who are deprived of that one parent, and recognize that it's important. A third of kids in this country sleep in a home without their own father. And the risks of child abuse increase as other mates are brought into the home, whether they're boyfriends or stepfathers. By the way, I'm not putting down step-parents because I'm one and my husband is one. So we are all in this together. So I'm not trying to demonize any group. I'm just simply saying we need to recognize how important it is to children's well-being, and also where we fail in our families, we tend to turn to government to pick up the slack, and I don't think we really want to forfeit our autonomy to more state involvement in our personal lives.
Back in just a minute with Kathleen Parker. Her new book is called Save the Males: Why Men Matter, Why Women Should Care. Our telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. Looks like we have lines full there, but you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, a way to keep your greatest two tools, imagination and curiosity, sharp.
Listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is syndicated columnist Kathleen Parker. Her newest book is called Save the Males: Why Men Matter, Why Women Should Care. Our telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. Let's speak to Audra in Dallas. Hi, Audra.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I had a comment a little earlier. Your guest, Ms. Parker, said something about how women are graduating from college a lot more often at higher rates than men. And she said, you know, later on down the road, who will these women marry? And that kind of surprised me, because it seems to me that's working on an assumption that women, you know, should not or will not marry men that are not as well educated as they are, or that somehow men should always be more educated than their wives. And I'm not sure if that's the what the guest meant, but it seems like that's an outdated assumption to me, and I think there are a lot of women who are married to men who don't have as high an education but still respect them.
That's a very interesting point. Thanks so much for your call. Kathleen?
Well, that is an interesting point, but I can just tell you this, that it's a fact that women don't marry men who are lesser educated, at least in great numbers. That may be changing. That may change over time, but for the most part, I hear from men all the time who say, I'm out of the marketplace because I don't have a college degree and I can't get anyone to want to go out with me or take me seriously. So, you know, this could shift over time. I don't know. I mean, I don't think we have enough data at this point to make those kind of judgments. But traditionally, and this goes back to our hunter-gatherer days, you know, women tend to seek out partners who are at least stable wage earners, because the fact of the matter is, most women do still give birth to the babies, We may be seeing a shift in that as well. But for the time being, when women do have babies, they often discover that they want to spend a little time with them, and in which case they need someone who can still pay the bills.
Do you think men discovering that educated women or more educated women are not interested in them is motivation enough for them to go and seek out additional education?
I think if men determine that they will get more sex if they get a higher degree, they'll go to graduate school.
So we don't have to worry so much about the imbalance.
Well, at this point, they're not being denied.
What about this argument? You know, you write in the book about manly men being valued. And I'm wondering if you think there's any weight to the argument that in the past, men who actually genuinely enjoyed things like cooking and caring for the kids in a pretty intimate way, giving them a bath or you know, picking out what they're going to wear the next day, have been prevented sort of artificially from enjoying those things.
No, I don't think so. I think, you know, a manly man does exactly what he wants to do, and he is has self-confidence and will do. Here's how I keep changing my definition of manliness as I try to come up with one. It doesn't really have to do with you know, it's not looks, it's not muscles, it's not posing, bravura, and all that. I was describing my husband the other day in an interview, and I said, you know, the thing I know about him, and I tell our boys this all the time, is that I always know that he'll do the right thing. And that's a stunning statement. It's I'm not sure anybody could say that about me, but I know that conclusively about him. And to me, that is, at this point, that's my working definition of manliness. Somebody who will always do the right thing, or certainly at least try.
Why isn't that the working definition of womanliness?
Well, I think it is. I think it should be. Let's just declare that right here and now.
So those two definitions are not necessarily...
No, they're not gender exclusive.
In apposition.
Okay. I don't think so, no.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Gabriel in Wichita Falls. Hi, Gabriel.
Hi. Am I on?
Yes.
Okay, sorry. Little transition. I was calling to comment about the fact that as a single father who's had custody of my children for years, what always would bother me in the media, and it seemed to happen a lot in commercials for sales of things, was the father would be portrayed as completely incompetent and unable to provide even the basic care to a child. And that used to drive me absolutely insane. And then as I've been listening to the show, a few other comments have entered in my mind. One of the other things that has always bothered me is that as a father taking care of my children, people make a really big deal of the fact that I take care of my children, and that's always bothered me. I mean, is everybody else's experience with fathers these incompetents who don't provide care to their children? I just don't see that as being the truth, and it always bothers me that people compliment me, go out of their way to compliment me on being a good father. It's just, you know, what you're supposed to do. It's nothing special. At least that's how I view it. It's not, shouldn't be anything special. It's what I'm supposed to do. I'm their father. I'm supposed to take care of them.
I hear you, Gabriel, and you're exactly right. Everybody, it's like, wow, he's being a good father. Let's give him an award. It's so demeaning and condescending. You're exactly on target when you say that commercials make men look like idiots and sitcoms make men look like idiots. You know, they can hardly tie their shoes without their more competent wife or even their kids coming in and telling them how to do it. There's a reason for this, and it's called money. 4 out of 5 sitcom viewers are women, so they seem to enjoy watching men act like fools. I guess it affirms their experience. And then as for commercials, women do most of the buying, including automotive supplies. So when you see men being made into buffoons, you can be sure that the advertisers are appealing to the person with the spending power in the family.
What's interesting about the buffoon dad phenomenon in sitcoms and commercials is that it doesn't really play itself out in dramatic television. You know, on 24 or on Lost, or, you know, the character's flaws don't usually include men being absolute dolts.
No, but they tend to be, men are also generally portrayed as violent or abusive or just, you know, criminally insane. You know, we always say, look, the families of the 50s, the Leave It to Beavers, the Father Knows Best, and all those people didn't exist. You know, those families were fictions. And let me just say this, they sort of were, but they also sort of weren't. Most children did have a father in the home. Most of them knew who was going to show up at the end of the day. And kids really like that. They love that predictable nature of life that we grown-ups tend to find sometimes tedious and boring. But also, you know, it doesn't matter if it's real or not. It's comforting to children to see these whole families operating. I know my son, when he was little, always watched Nickelodeon. He loved Dick Van Dyke and Mary Tyler Moore. I can promise you that what was going on downstairs didn't look like that, but it gave him pleasure to see it. So I don't know why we have to have reality TV for children. Give them a little dream or two. Let them fantasize.
There isn't the danger that it makes kids feel bad that their families aren't that?
I don't think so. I don't think so at all. I mean, you know, I wasn't upset that there was no Oz. You know, I like watching it. It was fun. That doesn't mean you can't. I mean, obviously, I'm not suggesting that we have, you know, Disney portrayals of everything on television. It'd be boring. But the balance right now is very much toward making men look like idiots, and children see that. So what do you have? You have these little boys growing up who maybe don't have a father in the home, maybe don't have any good role models, and so they turn on TV, and all they see is the guys are made to look foolish, and he thinks, well, gosh, is that what I am? You know, how do I grow up? What am I going to grow up to be? Now, I don't mean that we can make the world perfect, but I think we ought to make it balanced.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's speak next to Hari in Dallas. Hi, Hari.
Hi. I just had a comment about something she actually mentioned earlier.
Okay.
I think most kids are taught these days that men and women are equal, and then we have equal rights and equal duties and equal expectations. And a lot of times, most of the time, these kids grow up to be adults, and they have to be fathers, and they have to be mothers and husbands and wives who have equal rights, but they have different duties and different expectations. And I think that's actually the cause of a lot of divorce rate in this country, and also in other social situations, because these people get into relationships not realizing that they have to play a different role, or they have different expectations from each other, while they do have different, the same rights and dignity and everything else. I want to hear your guest comments on that.
Well, thanks. I'm trying to figure out, I think what I'm hearing you say is that the culture suggests that we behave one way and then the reality results in something else, and so people are dissatisfied and then...
Right, like growing up, I was taught men and women are equal, and that's how we all grew up, and then suddenly one day you realize, no, we are not equal. There are different things that are expected of me that are not expected of my wife, and vice versa.
Well, equal and identical, I guess, are two different concepts, too.
Well, exactly. Right. And you know, people do sort of self-select out of certain roles that they might have thought that they would find rewarding. When you're growing up in a classroom environment and learning about what gender roles look like, and then you actually get into the real life experience, you know, it doesn't always turn out just the way you think it would. I know that when I was growing up, I thought... First of all, I didn't think I'd ever get married or have children. That's what I really thought. But then when I did have a child, my assumptions about what it was going to be like to be a mother and do the career and family balancing act and all that, my assumptions were completely at odds with what my feelings were and what my real experience turned out to be. I did not, in fact, want to drop my child off at daycare like you do the dry cleaning and dash back to the office. In fact, I wanted to stay home. And I didn't, you know, you'd have to pry that baby out of my arm. So imagine my surprise that I would feel that way. So it could just be that you discover that real life is not at least not exactly according to the textbook. And I think you're right that some people maybe find that that's a disappointment. Perhaps the woman feels that way, wants to stay home with the baby, and the husband says, well, that's not what I signed on for. You know, I expect you to go back to work and contribute financially. Well, you've got a big problem there. Women may see other men pitching in more with the kids and be dissatisfied with him because he's not, he's not willing to whip up a souffle at the end of his day. So, you know, again, I think, you know, we have to kind of back off these very finely honed cultural expectations and become more real with ourselves and see, you know, have a conversation. You don't have to, there's no template. And I think we're coming in with these unrealistic expectations.
Are you teaching your sons things? And I know a couple of them are fully adult, and they're all pretty close to that. But did you teach your sons things that about being men that are different appreciably from cultural norms in America today?
I don't think I did. Fortunately or not, my young son, I had two stepsons who are quite a bit older, and they're now married and out in the world. And I didn't I don't think I had as much influence on them except as, you know, as an example of the perfect woman.
Forgive me for laughing, but I'm not the perfect woman either.
That was being funny. But my son, who I raised from the day he was born, he was just a tidy freak. So I didn't have to teach him to pitch in around the house. I was sort of hoping he'd leave his clothes on the floor every now and then, not be quite so perfect. But I don't know. I don't think I did. I think these things sort of sort themselves out. My son is very honest with me. We have very open conversations about all of these things. And I sense with him and his age group, I'm talking about the 20-somethings, a bit of confusion about how to relate to the opposite sex. You know, they're fluent in pornography and they know a whole lot about hooking up, but they don't really kind of know how to have a real relationship and how to have true intimacy. And that's the thing that I think is most concerning about how we've constructed our lives.
Do you think maybe, though, that every generation has to learn? Like, you can read all the books and you can take the tips from your culture and you're going to want to be somewhat different from your parents. And unfortunately, all of us have to labor through that sort of relationship adolescence with the opposite sex or with the same sex, if that's the case.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know what? Our kids are those 20-somethings. I mean, the reason my older stepsons just got married in their 30s is because they don't want to repeat the mistakes of their parents. They saw all their friends and their own parents divorce, and they feel, you know, they experienced that great dysfunction and pain, and they're not about to do that. They're not about to repeat those mistakes. So who knows? Maybe ultimately we're creating a new generation of very conservative homebodies. We'll see. But they're, you know, those 35-year-olds, 31-year-olds, they are a different generation than the 20-somethings because they've had a whole different experience as well. So I don't know where it goes. But I do think that with the prevalence of sexually transmitted diseases and heartbreak out there, they're going to be looking for some new way to have a relationship.
And very briefly, do you think it's possible the pendulum will swing back so that it's hanging in the right place from your perspective?
Oh, I hope so. I think, I mean, that's the goal. You know, the goal, the pendulums love to swing wildly, and eventually they come back toward the center, but we have to sort of help it drag that way.
Kathleen Parker will appear at the Borders on Preston Road in Dallas tonight at 7 o'clock. You can find more information at borderstores.com. The new book is called Save the Males, Why Men Matter, Why Women Should Care. Kathleen, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you so much. I enjoyed it.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.